Eli O'Mara on Mix 92.6.
Right, so that song, not normally part of our playlist, but it has been played as a special homage to Phil Smee, who's in the studio with me.
Hi, Eli.
Hello.
Good to be here. Yeah.
Oh, honestly, there's a lot of excitement about you being here, generally across a number of people, fellow presenters, other people who know. So on social media, I put it out there. Jez Levy literally posted the Motorhead logo. So he knows who you are. Phil Smee rocks, is what he said. So, Phil, you're a graphic designer. You're a music journalist, you're a record collector, you've got a huge knowledge of the history of music. Tell us a little bit about your career, kind of how it started and what you got into.
Well, I mean, as far as music concerned, music has been my life. You know, in fact, so many people say, so let's get this straight. You love music more than anything else, and your job is designing in the music to business, and you collect music. That's not really a job.
That's not a job.
That's a hobby come true, you know. And I say, well, it is.
It's a paid hobby.
Exactly. So I say, well, it's not as simple as that, because, you know, you have to shape your own destiny. But it's just that I moved in circles where I got known for certain things. And I've been collecting records, you see, since 1961.
Wow.
Bought my first record. And then I... by the time I was 14, 15, if people came around to see my friends, they'd always say, wow, you've got so many records. I mean, I probably had 50 singles and about 7 albums, you know, but more than anyone else. But that's what I was like. And I used to, I saved up for a tape recorder. And when I was 14, with my paper round and Saturday jobs and things, and I bought a tape recorder and I used to tape Pick of the Pops every Sunday, all the new releases, all the new chart entries, and I kept books. I've still got them. I've still got
books
with all the details, what labels they're on, and I used to have little symbols if I thought it was going to be a hit, T in a circle, coloured in blue, meant it's going to top 10, you know. And it was all this, and I kept all this stuff. I was just absorbed with music. It was my life. So when I went to art school, I could always draw. I was always good at art, but going to art school really was to learn how to create and come up with new ideas. You know, that was what it's all about. So, and I came out of art school full of ways of doing things. And of course, I didn't go into the music business because it's very difficult to get into. I started designing books. That's what I did first, and I did that for a time. But then the punk thing happened, and suddenly record companies were cropping up little labels. So I started my own in St Albans, my own label, Waldo's Records, which was the local punk label, you know. And we did a few things, and then someone got noticed, and I got people asking me if I would do their stuff, you know. I turned some down because I had too many. The manager of U2 asked, do you want to do this, our band? I said, what are they called? So U2. I thought, no.
Was didn't have a T in blue, did it? Top 10, U2.
No, no. Well, in fact, they played St Albans. That's why they played at the arena. You know, and he said, oh, you're the guy who does it. I said, but I've got so much work coming in that a few years later, I had the record company. That's when I went freelance. So I went freelance when I was 29. But before that, I'd even done Motorhead. I'd done a lot of interesting things, which weren't huge names at the time. You know, in fact, Motorhead was unknown. I went to see them in a squat in Notting Hill Gate.
Wow!
And Lemmy was great because he kind of knew what he wanted. He had this picture, which he showed me, with a drawing of this pig with a helmet. And I said, yes, but I do his voice. He said, yeah, Phil, we want something really, really Germanic. What do you think? You know. So I thought, okay, Germanic. What's that? You know. So I came home and I designed this logo, which at the time, it was because he'd said that, I thought, well, I need something a bit old-fashioned, you know. And I looked through these big boxes I had of old, what we used to call letter set. There's different makes, but that was one of the makes. These are letters that you rubbed off and made artwork. And I found something which I thought, well, this is pretty good, you know. And the trouble is, I didn't have all the letters. I only had some of the letters. Some of them were missing because I'd used it before, you know. So I decided to use that but make up the letters that were missing. Like, made the M at the beginning, I had to draw that, and then the H, I didn't have an H. So I thought, what can I do in H? And so I used an L and then used a bit off a W upside down and joined it up and retouched it. And then when I was doing it, the two dots over the O came off the sheet because they had accents on the letters, you know, some of them. And I thought, oh, hang on, that looks Germanic. That's what Lemmy wants. Great, I left it on, finished the whole thing, put it up to have a look at. And I thought, that doesn't look like a record sleeve at all. It just looks like some amateur's done it. It didn't look good because it was a bit of whiteboard with this lettering and everything. And I thought, I'll reverse it. I'll make it black out of white, and which made the drawing look completely different. You couldn't even tell what it was, but it looked like a record sleeve. So I did that, and I gave it and took it up to them. Lemmy loved it. He said, that's brilliant.
But that's... So... The only reason I'm interrupting is because I just want people to know you were the creator of the Motorhead logo.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when you look at the size of that heavy metal band now.
I suppose it just ticked a balance. But the other thing is that the idea of using that kind of old English gothic sort of face, it was taken on by all sorts of heavy metal bands. It became the sort of thing you did. You know, they all ended up having that kind of thing because it's sort of instantly recognisable. Then, oh, that's heavy metal. You know, it's old English.
But it's synonymous with heavy metal, the old gothic-y type writing.
So that's what it did. But in between that, I mean, I was just working in the evenings at that point. I was only 27, so I was doing stuff and going to work. But it soon took over, and... I think it was 29, and I thought, you know, I think I could do this all the time.
But when I researched you, Phil, when I had a bit of a look at, up at what you did. So you, St Albans born and bred, and you would buy records every week, wouldn't you? So
absolutely,
whereabouts would you buy records?
Well, at the record room.
Okay.
In St Albans, the record room, fantastic shop.
Okay.
I mean, I knew the guys in there, obviously, because I was in there all the time.
Because you were in there all the time.
And I used to order records. Because obviously they stocked the top 10 and some stuff, but I would go in and order things like the Misunderstood single that I just heard on John Peel, you know, and they would get it in those days. They got it in without 2 days. They would get your record in for you know. Interesting enough, though, there's another record shop in on the other side of the road in Checker Street called Elliot's, and Elliot's sold electrical goods, hi-fis, all sorts of things, and they had a little record bar. And Elliot's were the chart return shop for St Albans.
Oh, okay.
Which is why, when you look at the map of the country and how they put the charts together, they used to use chart return shops, which are steady shops that were run properly by people in suits. And they took their sales, they amalgamated them all and made up the charts, record retailer charts. Well, really, that's why they were so weird, the charts in the 60s. You'd think that everyone was out buying Engelbert Humperdinck and everything.
Yeah.
Well, that's because they used these shops. On the other side of the road, the record room, we're all buying obscure stuff, Misunderstood and Fleur de Lis and all those sort of bands, you know. So, and of course, they never... And it was because of that, just as an aside, the Beatles' Strawberry Fields Forever didn't get to number one in the record retailer charts because the chart return shops they were using were selling more Engelbert Humperdinck Please Release Me singles.
Wow.
And, of course, Beatles outsold that by miles.
Yeah.
Didn't get to number one because no one asked the people who were buying. Anyway, that was that. So buying loads and loads of records was every penny I got went on music, or I taped it and I just started building up this huge library, you know.
And when did you start listening to John Peel? So radio must have been an important part.
Well,
and John Peel was incredible for that stuff that, you know, nobody else really knew about. He was about discovering new stuff, wasn't he?
He started off on Radio London, of course. You see, Radio London was one of the pirate radios, which were in the in the North Sea, just off Frinton. And he was one of the DJs on Radio London. And Radio London had a very good transmitter, very loud. You could get it over here easily, you know, louder than Radio Caroline, louder than Radio England. And when they shut the pirates down, they rehired all the good DJs, and they thought they'd better hire him because he has such a big listenership. He had a program called The Perfume Garden on Radio London. So they gave him this spot on Sunday. But I'd been taping his stuff on Radio London anyway. So then I began taping all of his shows, you know, which I've still got loads of tapes.
Wow.
So I've got a massive archive. And, yeah, he influenced everything that people listen to. And, you know, he championed people that, just out of the blue, people would send him stuff. You know, so Tyrannosaurus Rex, Mark Bolan, he just basically played it. No one else was going to play that kind of stuff, you know, and look what became of them.
And it's just incredible. And what about, so you went to Watford School of Art, didn't you? So was that, well, I mean, it must have been helpful, but it sounds like you had your own ideas anyway, so...
With a lot of influential people, and they had guests that come in, that people they knew, so they were very well connected. We had big artists came in, Klaus Oldenburg, Eduardo Palazzi. We had Eno, before Roxy Music, he came in once and did a thing, and Mark Boyle, who did all the light shows and everything, he came. We had lots of connections, and it meant that we, not commissions that we could use in the future, but they were really welcome for a place in Watford, art school in Watford, you know. So that was good fun. And after 3 years, they always say, you know, things may come, things may go, but the art school dance goes on forever, you know, because you learned how to create and be in a creative situation. And that's all about coming up with ideas is what design's all about. Anyone can learn to draw and be neat and everything, but to come up with new ideas and people... in recently, you know, would say, how do you think of new ideas? And I say, well, the longer you do it, the more they come. I've had ideas on the phone when they're asking me, can you think about Mike Oldfield's new album? It's going to be called Man on the Rocks, and he likes, wants you to come up with something. While they're talking to me, I'm sketching stuff. I'm doing my ideas starting, you know. So, it's quite, you know, so you just get used to it. He's coming up with good ideas.
But you were a graphic designer before graphic designers were really a thing. So was it computer generated art? Did it move into that? Was it just kind of freehand drawing?
Well, if you look at a lot of the records that came out in the 50s and 60s, mostly the large proportion of them are photographs. They're just photography. You had a photograph of the band, like the Beatles, first, you know, second. Third one was a lovely one because it had all the pictures, Hard Day's Night. Fourth one, picture of them. Fifth one, picture of them. Sixth one, 1966, an illustration. Now, that was so unusual. Klaus Voormann's illustration for Revolver was so interesting. In design terms, it was... people just sort of think about it now as, well, it's another record sleeve. But illustrated record sleeves were very unusual. And... So as it got more into that, so more artists got involved, you know, and because you don't always want... In fact, Led Zeppelin only had one picture of the band ever on one of their albums, and they were dressed up as World War II airmen.
All right, yeah.
So a lot of bands, there was a fantastic band called High Tide, whose both albums are wonderful, very obscure. They never had a picture of them anywhere. And to this day, I don't think I'd recognise a picture of them because never they look like. So once we got involved with doing graphics and coming up with ideas, then, and the punk thing helped. The punk thing was fantastic because I was doing bands like The Damned and all sorts of bands, and they want something a bit outrageous, a bit interesting.
Yeah.
So I was great for that, you know. And I was working with Johnny Rotten, John Lydon I did all the Pillboxes, I've done loads of stuff. And they love it because they love anything that's a bit unusual. They were up for it, you know, that was the interesting thing. Was if you did a Barry Manilow album, they don't.
Yeah,
think
no, that wasn't going to happen.
Sticky tape all over it, you know.
No, right. So we have got a couple of questions. Oh. Ellie on Hertfordshire's Mix 92.6. I am chatting to Phil Smee. We're going to be talking about his love of reggae. Are you a lover of reggae?
Yeah, well, more of what we call the silver and golden ages. So it's the late 60s or 60s into the 70s, and that's a sort of fantastic age for reggae. And I collect labels. I collect the Jamaican Pressings, Studio One, and Coxon. I mean, I used to go to Peckham's in London, shop there. I used to sell Studio One records. So that's all the early records by bands like the Wailers. They were on Studio One before, obviously, they got famous. And I love all that stuff. I've got a big, big collection, mostly 45s, because that's what they, you know, really crackly pressings.
Yeah, so we are getting to Becky's question. She'll kill me if we don't, Phil. But I do just have to ask, do you do you listen? How many have you got, and how can you possibly listen to them?
Well, okay, to answer that, there's two prongs. One, I've got about 12,500 singles and about 10,500 albums, vinyl. This is, and I do have about 8,000 CDs, but they're in another room, all in boxes and in special sleeves, because I throw all the plastic sleeves away.
Right. Okay.
Re-sleeve everything. So take up too much room.
Yeah.
Out of that lot, I collect whole labels. One of the labels I collect is the Elektra, from 1954 to 1974, and I've got virtually every record released on that label in America, and all of them from England. So they take up a big chunk of things. You know, there's about half of them I've never played. So my record collection, the albums, I would say, I've probably only played about three quarters of them.
Right, okay.
And the same with the singles. I've got loads I haven't played.
Right.
Because I collect everything by people. So, you know, whether it's Lulu or it's more obscure stuff like American bands like Jefferson Airplane or whatever. I've got everything. And I haven't played them. I mean, I'd assume they're all right. I've got special binders, which have got all singles for different bands. And they actually, all those are bound with, full of all their records, you know. So someone like, say, Petula Clark, for instance, there's about 10 volumes, you know. So that's 180, 200 singles and EPs, you know. So I haven't played them, but I will get round to it.
Yeah, at some point. Now I'm going back to your designing, okay? And this is the question from Becky.
Okay.
So you have created some of the most instantly recognisable logos and designs in the music world, images that have become part of our cultural history. Mm. Yet, for many people, you won't be known as the man behind them unless people do research. And they've got to do quite thorough research as well, I think. So how does it feel to have that kind of silent fame, to see your work everywhere but not necessarily have your name in lights?
I tell you, I don't network. In fact, I've got a reputation even in the music industry as being willfully obscure.
Okay.
A few years ago, Universal got rid of a lot of people, a lot of their staff. They slimmed down, you know. And Universal owned everything in Polydor, every, you know, Tamla Motown. And one of the guys left, who was leaving, a guy called Chris, phoned me to say, Phil, I'm leaving. I said, why are you leaving? He said, well, we're thinning around. I've lost my job. I just wanted to say amazing stuff we've done over in the past together, you know. And we never met, and that was 15 years I'd known him.
Wow.
You know? So that was that. But being anonymous is, no one had a, you look at any of the Beatles albums, and up until, you didn't get a credit, unless you were really, everyone knows that Andy Warhol did the first Velvet Underground cover, but that was Andy Warhol, you know. So you didn't get a credit. Nowadays, it's a bit like films. You used to watch a film, the credits at the end took about 10 seconds.
Yeah, they did.
Producer, director, lighting, done, you know.
Yeah.
Now, they have to put a different bit of music on, so it's going to be 8 minutes before you get through everyone, you know. So I don't mind that. I do like when I've done something that's people mention, and I say, well, yeah, that's mine. I mean, one of the things that I told people about is a film called Back to the Future.
Yeah. Oh, a little film. Not sure many people
remember. Spielberg was one of his first producer things, and there's the scene where he goes back into 1955, and the music's playing is the Cordettes, Mr. Sandman, and he walks out. Well, you know, where am I? Where am I? And he sees a record shop, and he goes over to the record shop. And outside is a kind of a stand that goes on the pavement, you know, outside the shop. And on the stand is a blown up Cordettes album, pale blue, a dusty pink. The girls, real 50s iconic looking sleeve, obviously appealed to him because it says 50s, and they're playing the music. Well, I designed that album in 1984, so it wouldn't have been around in 1955, but just to see that, you know, I think, look, that's my flipping record, you know, yeah. Beginning of the film.
It's just incredible, though, and it must be. So I get it, and I think, yeah, we say in the old days, but there wasn't that kind of credit, but now, is there not a little bit of
I don't know. I do get credited on some of the stuff that I did, but Yeah, I mean, there was so much stuff. It got a bit embarrassing if you keep putting...
In fact, that's me.
When I was doing the Damned, we did an album called Machine Gun Etiquette, which I still got all the bits for, but made this sort of model thing, and we... the day we shot it, up in I lived in a little road called Liverpool Road at that time, in the middle of St Albans, and we shot it, and I set fire to it, and we took some photos of it burning, and then we went down the local pub called the Horn.
Yeah, we know.
And when I went in there with the Damned, you know, and all the punks were amazed to see the band walking in their pub, and when I was doing the credits, and Rat, who's the drummer, you know, the guy from the record company said, "You better put a credit for you." And I said, "What about, I've just put artwork, Phil Smee." And Rat said, "Art? Work?" So in that credit, it says art, work, Phil Smee. Because as far as he was concerned, what work is there involved? What's the art part of it, you know?
So I've got a question in from Jez. What's your favourite artwork by another artist that you really admire for an album cover or wish that you'd had the idea?
My favourite album sleeve designer was a guy called William S. Harvey. And he was the designer for Elektra Records. And he designed all the bands, like the Doors and everything. And he had this thing. He was the first one. He was the guy who first, if you were signed to Elektra Records, you got a logo. And he designed the logo. So Love got a logo, fantastic logo. Doors got a logo, Clear Light, the Stooges, everybody got a logo. And his designs are wonderful. And my favourite sleeve of all time is Love's second album. It's called Da Capo. Great photo of them in Hollywood Hills, looking amazing, and it's in a gold frame. It's so simple, it's beautiful album sleeve. It's my favourite album sleeve. Bill Harvey, yeah, he was amazing. In fact, when I used to credit some of the things I did, if I was fed up with putting my own name, I used to call myself Harvey S. Williams, his name back to front.
All right, yeah.
So I'm on some sleeves, I'm credited as Harvey S. Williams, just for the fun of it, you know, and I used other pseudonyms on different sleeves sometimes, just for fun.
Kelly on Hertfordshire's Mix 92.6. Now, I have to say, I'm just going a little bit off norm at the moment because I haven't allowed Phil Smee, music journalist, designer and record collector, to leave the building. I've made sure he's still sitting in front of me because there's still some questions coming in. So, Phil, trickiest band you've had to deal with and why?
Well, I don't want to spill the beans. And there's some horrible people I've dealt
I'm
with,
sure.
And horrible managers.
Okay.
Although, I must say, when I was first asked to work with the Sex Pistols, which was, we were doing an anniversary of the first album, but I was doing it to a big, big box set, and they got in touch with me at Universal to say, would I be up for doing it? And I said, well, of course, why not? And he said, well, because the designer that we got before bailed on us. He couldn't take it.
I said, okay,
well, that's... He said, but, you know, we'll pay you danger money if that's all right. I said, yeah, fine, you know. Turns out, I got on so well with them. And John's manager, who's unfortunately died now, a guy called Rambo, I could see why people didn't get on with him. He was really hard work.
But is that a fellow rebel in you? Was that a bit of a,
because
you know?
If you play it right, you know, a lot of these people have trouble with the record company. But I'm in between. So I'm kind of on their side, but I'm also on the record company's side. I'm a go-between. I'm Switzerland. I can be, I can sort of say, oh, they're like that, aren't they? They're always doing that, you know.
And then to the other one going, oh, yeah. God, they're a nightmare, but don't worry, I'm exactly. Sorting it, I'm all over
but
it.
I got on so well with them. They were even, John Lydon and his manager would phone me up from the Emirates during the football match when they were playing Liverpool because they support Arsenal, and laughing if Liverpool had gone behind, you know. Yeah, they was just the phone would ring, and I could hear their
just abuse down the phone.
Yeah, exactly. So that was fun. No, they were great. Other people, I've dealt with so many people, but the people who are really, really talented are often the ones that are so easy to get on with.
Yeah. Okay.
And one of my faves was Mike Oldfield. Now Mike lives in the Bahamas, but he did come across when he opened up the Olympics. You know, he did the whole beginning bit with the English in London, you know, with the National Health, with that whole sequence of dancing and everything. He played that live, and he played the music to me in his hotel to say, this is the music I've composed for it, you know. And his manager said, don't just play that to anyone. And I said, well, I'm not going to remember it and sing
it. Replicate it, yeah.
But he was lovely. And it got to the point where some of the... In fact, I mentioned it before, an album called Man on the Rocks. And I thought, what I'd like to do with him is some of the earliest cave paintings in history were when the people, cave guys, dipped their hands in pigment and put the handprints on the walls. They're the earliest known pieces of art, you know. And I thought, well, I'll get Mike to trace his hands and then we'll do his handprints on the wall in the cave and it was looking out, you know, Man on the Rocks. It was kind of symbolic because he'd had a divorce and everything. So, and he was really up for it. He's great. And he traced his hands and he sent them over. And then I said, go around the house. I want you to take lots of pictures, just like just things in the house, you know, and in the garden. So I want to do one of those kind of middle spreads like I used to get on progressive rock albums, you know, where you have lots of pictures, doesn't mean anything, you know. And he loved it. And he took a big picture of this beautiful tree in his garden. It's in the Bahamas, which I used on the inside as a, because he said, that's what I look at when I'm recording. That's my tree. You know. 2 months later, they had a hurricane went through, blew the tree down. And he said, he phoned up and said, I'm so glad you put that on, because if it's gone now,
the only way he can see it.
And I will always remember, because the tree is in the inner bag of the album. Anyway, so in fact, that was the next album that we put the tree on. Called Return to Omidorn. And so he was lovely. Elvis Costello, I have to say about him, he was lovely to work with. He was really, you know, when someone is talented, they don't have to be, you know, try to sort of big themselves up.
No, so the ego, yeah. It's not a...
But the worst things were managers, who are the go-between, you know, most of the time, and that they're the ones that could be a bit... they just want it. They want to seem like they're doing something, I think.
Yeah.
So I can't really name some of the people, but they're kind of famous people, but there are some lovely people and some people, like, for instance, Paul McCartney's brother Mike. And I've worked with him on loads of stuff. I've just done their box set for The Scaffold and everything. In fact, I've still got his archives up in my studio, all his photos and posters. And he is amazingly, and I've never met Paul McCartney. I'd love to meet him one day, but he is my absolute hero of all time. I consider him Paul McCartney.
Paul, if you're listening, Phil Smith.
Paul, I did some singles for him in the 90s. I did all the Apple label in the 90s. I did all sorts of stuff for them. Now I consider Paul the world's greatest living composer, I think.
Wow.
I think that's what he is. But those sort of, you know, people who deserve to be where they are often the nicest people. The people who are pain are the ones who are sort of... I think they sometimes think that they have to keep asserting themselves somehow to make a point, you know, to justify their fame.
And then,
And I think they kind of get it that I don't share their enthusiasm for themselves.
So we can't... I think that's fair enough that we're not going to name.
No.
We're not going to name and shame. And in the big scheme of things, people get stressed and they can be horrible in the moment, and that's not necessarily. So we do know
I'm quite
that.
Good at soaking up bad things, though, because I'm quite diplomatic.
Yeah, which is good. Yeah. So, Phil, I am running out of time. Okay. Now, you've said you're obscure and that, you know, people... We don't normally kind of see much of you, but would you come back again? So,
I'd love to. Yeah, we could talk more about music and just maybe sort of say stuff, and these people can check stuff out.
Yes.
You know, because most people's outlook on music is a bit narrow, because they don't really know the depth of stuff that's out there. And a lot of music, good music out there, is based on other stuff anyway. So, you know, people go wild about Oasis. Well, Oasis are just a copy band, and they're nothing
the
90s, special.
Yeah,
I'm not a big fan, and you know. But so if you go back to where they got it from, and even with the Beatles, go where do they get it from? You know, bands like the Donnays, American girl band from 1959, I think 1960, had a song called "He's Got the Devil in His Heart," which they covered. It's good to go back to those early records when you hear them, because there's very few people who've ever heard that record. Yeah. You think, wow, that's where they got it from. It sounds amazing, you know.
Right, we'll get it on our playlist. Well, Steve Simpson, so. Add it to the playlist. Phil, honestly, yeah. We could be here days, but yeah. We will be ejected from the studio at some point. But we'd love to have you back again for further chat and, you know, with just something maybe a little bit more structured rather than just this fabulous conversation that I'm getting to have and our listeners are getting to hear. So huge thank you to Phil Smee.
Ellie O'Mara on Mix 92.6.